With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm the New Statesman's web editor, Caroline Crampton, standing in again for your usual host, Helen Lewis, as she's still on holiday. Every week, the New Statesman team bring you an exciting mixture of discussion, interviews, and stories.
Formerly the Secretary of Public Affairs at Lambeth Palace and currently an Anglican priest and writer. And George has written the cover story for the New Statesman this week, in which, George, you've coined the concept of the new power Christians. Who are they?
Well, Sophie, I think you called them the power Christians, actually. but I agree with you. I think there's a new generation of Christian witness coming through in places like the City of London, in commerce more generally, but in the financial markets. During the boom years up to 2008, it was really about surviving as a Christian in the city. How to live your faith in the city had with it implications that that it was difficult. And it was difficult because if you declared your Christian faith, you were deemed to be marginal, some sort of fanatic, probably not as good at making money as the clear-eyed Gordon Geckos of the financial markets. Since 2008, and since the sort of false gods of the free markets have been exposed, I think there's a new confidence in Christians in the city, probably people of any religion, but I mean, I'm noting it particularly with regard to my own faith and Christianity and so on. And I think now it's not about sort of surviving with your faith in the city. It's more a question of what we describe as more Mr. Nice Guy, by which I mean making one's own witness to Christianity non-negotiable. No, this informs my entire life, and therefore my work and the markets must serve these tenets of faith.
And beyond that, I mean, one of the people you speak to in the piece describes using business as a means of advancing the kingdom of God. So, I mean, it's sort of taking it a step further even. And what did he mean by that?
Well, if you're to accept that that we are living in God's creation, I mean, I don't think you need to be a swivel-eyed creationist to claiming that the world was made in 6 days, etc., etc., and is only 10,000 years old. But if you're accepting that God is in all parts of creation, then clearly he's in financial markets as much as he is in the church fate. He is in the processes of banking as much as he is in fair trade and worthy activities of volunteering and charity work and so on. And if that's the case, then what you're talking about is what really the Bible refers to as the powers and principalities, which in those days were kingdoms and the Roman Empire and so on. And now, of course, are multinational companies and global finance. Mm. So what these people are saying is that if the powers and principalities in the old days needed to be turned to the advancement of the kingdom of heaven, then so do the financial markets today.
Mm.
But I should have put that in my piece.
But the pursuit of profit to the degree that we still see it in the City of London, it's not that that's changed since 2008. I mean, in many ways, they're back to their old ways. I mean, is that always in keeping with the tenets of your faith?
Well, there's nothing particularly wicked about making profits. It's The big question that we need to ask is, who does your wealth enrich?
Yeah.
If it's just about enriching oneself, then that's likely to blind you to what's happening in the world. But if you can put it to the service of the world, and lots of people I've been speaking to, or at least one or two of the people I've been speaking to for purposes of this feature, are demonstrably using the wealth that they generate in the city to further the circumstances and lives of people that are very much more disadvantaged. You know, there are those that are putting their wealth to work in proper gospel witness in terms of assisting the poorest and most vulnerable in our world. And that, as the Gospels tell us, is what serving the Christ is all about.
Mm. And of course...
you sound sceptical.
Well, I only slightly. Justin Welby, the new Archbishop of Canterbury, has a background in this world. And I wonder, how does he fit into the picture?
Well, you say he has a background in this world, and it's undoubtedly the case that he had a few years as a finance director of big oil companies in the 1980s. Actually, I don't think that's as significant as his time... in Holy Trinity, Brompton, the kind of city whiz kids church in Knightsbridge, and from there into a wider set of church traditions, the Catholic tradition he was exposed to in the Anglo-Catholic, that is, tradition as Dean of Liverpool, and in his work in Africa in dispute resolution and so on. So he has a very wide experience. But I think what's interesting about Welby is that he has a lot of worldly experience, and also he's something of an outsider. He comes from a very privileged background, but he's of the establishment, but also able to be a thorn in the side of the establishment. He comes from a rather eccentric family that is descended from the great dynasties of the Conservative Party, and therefore is sort of born into the establishment. But he then in adulthood discovered that it had been kept from him that his paternal grandfather was a Jewish immigrant. And I think this has given him an interesting mixture of being of the establishment, but something of a seed of its own destruction. I think his ability to be an outsider gives him the ability to tap into that kind of radical alternative Christian idea, that outrageous idea that the world isn't about building up treasures for yourself, but about loving your neighbour. And if the city, you know, he's the sort of person that can see how that purpose can be fulfilled through the city as much as through the church.
As different in character though and background to your former boss Rowan Williams as could be.
I think we're all unique as human beings, but we're all very much the same as human beings too. It's one of the sort of great wonders of the human condition. But you can tell I'm avoiding a direct answer to your question there, because I'm very fond of Rowan Williams. But I think you're right to observe that Rowan had a formidable intellectual brain that was schooled and developed in the groves of academe. Actually, he's a very worldly bloke. He'd served a lot of his ministry in some of the harshest sharp ends of society in Wales, where the economy is really in many parts flat on its back and there is real poverty. So he knows what's going on in the world. But I think you're right to observe that his gifts are very cerebral, and probably Justin Welby's gifts are very practical and in terms of application and a sort of contextual theology. So I think Justin Welby would differ in as much as he's probably more prepared to get down and dirty with institutions in our society such as the banks, and we've seen him being highly critical on the parliamentary committee into the fixing of interest rates where he does ask very searching questions of bankers. And, you know, I think that very directness probably is different from Rowan's very cerebral consideration of all the alternatives. Mm. Both very valuable witnesses, but different in their ways.
Mm. Thank you very much, George.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my name's Philip Horn. I'm joined by Sophie Elmhurst to talk about nature writing. Last week, Alice O'Keefe published a review of a book called Holloway by Robert McFarlane, Stanley Donwood and Dan Richards. And in this review, she raised a few issues with what might be called the new nature writing. What were her problems, Sophie?
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting piece and it sort of touches on, lots of different points about the new nature writing. And it has been a really fertile, interesting sort of part of our literature, I think, especially in the last, say, 5-10 years, with people like Robert McFarlane, who she is obviously writing about. I think her sort of main problem, having been a great admirer of such sort of wild writing, as she calls it, and the works of Roger Deakin, who's the kind of godfather of the movement, if you like, is in some ways I think her concluding point is one of the most important, which is its lack of humour, that in some ways, and she sort of absolves Deakin from this, but in this particular review of Holloway, there's an earnestness, there's a seriousness, there's a lack of kind of levity and humanity almost to it, that we've maybe taken sort of nature writing to this rather stultifying place. And the writers are maybe taking themselves quite seriously as well, and I think there is something interesting in that, in that it's a form that perhaps does more than others summon a kind of perhaps a sort of over reverence of its subject.
Mm. And she talks about the movement and its sort of need for kind of escape, you know. Is this work escapism, would you say, or do you think there's a political dimension? I mean, is it more complex than that?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. And I think, at the New Statesman, we've sort of bought in nature writing in the last couple of years quite purposefully and expressly with a political edge, I think, in the writings, for example, of John Burnside, who writes a regular nature column at the back of the magazine. And I think absolutely the key thing to say about the form in its best sense is when it's grappling with those issues, with the idea of how we fit into this natural world and how we have a human relationship with it, which is an entirely political, in some ways, a political relationship. And that the idea that it's something which is just beautiful and separate, that we admire, that it's sort of pure, is clearly misguided, not only because of environmental issues, because of climate change, because of our impact on the natural world, but just because it's a living, breathing, changing thing that we are mixed up with, and that, as John Burnside does so well, I think, and whenever he writes, he's always talking, you know, it's always full of admiration and poetic kind of discussion of the subject, whether it's magnolia trees or insects or a bird that he loves in Scotland where he lives. But there'll always be an element which is really trying to get to grips with what's our place in this and what are we doing and what, you know, the green movement, is that in any way grappling with the realities of our relationship with the natural world?
On that, this is what I think is one of the distinguishing features of more recent nature writing, is it seems to have moved beyond a kind of, kind of apocalyptic vision of what's happening in the countryside. So we have a piece in this week's magazine by Richard Mabey about ash dieback, about what's happening to our trees. And it's a really interesting piece because it doesn't just say, oh, you know, we've got very low, you know, diversity, the kind of narrative that you heard on the radio, you know, it's all kind of downhill. And I think something that seems to be emerging in a lot of nature writing that I've seen is the idea that nature is not only something that needs to be defended, that it has its own defense mechanism, and that things, you know, that we shouldn't see ourselves as being aside from nature, and that, you know, I mean, John Gray is utterly convinced that, you know, nature will take care of us before we'll take care of nature.
Well, no, it's a really interesting sort of territory, because absolutely, Mabee's point in this piece about ash trees, and it's a beautiful piece of writing, is absolutely, who are we in a way to think that we can fix this, that we can control this, and that often, and it's something that John Burnside shares in his thinking about the natural world, that there are elements of the green movement, of conservation movement, that are in a way are that sort of frenetic overmanaging of nature, that we think that we know best, that we've got the answers. So whether it's replanting certain types of tree, or you know, frantically worrying and sort of managing landscapes or particular wildlife populations, and that in our interference, which is often with the best of intentions, that we actually have, we don't necessarily do more harm than good, but we're not letting nature get on with it. And that quite often, and he cites, for, you know, after the 1987 storm, for example, that nature has a wonderful way of taking its own course, and without our interference and without sort of human interaction. And then in a way, and again, he's written a wonderful book, Beachcombings, about this, maybe about his experience of having his own beechwood, and how he sort of loved it and immersed himself in it and loved sort of prettifying it and, you know, making sure that he was encouraging the younger beech trees to grow, and, you know, was frantically involved with it, and then sort of finally realised that it had become essentially another form of play, sort of human playground, and that really wasn't what the sort of wider purpose of this was, that actually, if you're really interested in wildness and in nature doing its thing, then you let it be.
Thanks, Sophie.
Earlier this week, Rebellion, publishers of British anthology comic 2000 AD, revealed that it was preparing to reprint Grant Morrison and Steve Yeol's Zenith, exploring ideas of generational inheritance, fame and iconography through the lens of a less than heroic son of a superhero. Zenith has been out of print for over 20 years now. Long ago, it had gained the status of one of comics' lost classics, one of a number of titles which, due to copyright issues, intransigent creators or just plain pigheadedness, seemed likely to never be reprinted, despite their obvious brilliance. But where other greats like Alan Moore's Marvel Man and Osamu Tezuka's Phoenix are only available if you've got a large budget and a lot of time to trawl eBay, Zenith is coming back, albeit in a limited run of 1,000 copies of a £100 deluxe hardcover. That ought to be fantastic news for a select few of lucky comics fans, but it's tempered by the fact that Grant Morrison himself, the writer of the comic, has refused to comment on the reprint. Way back in the late 1980s, when Zenith was written, 2000 AD and the British comics industry in general was a very different place. Although all of the work done there was so-called work for hire, where the artist is paid a fee for their work and the publisher owns their creations, there was little paperwork and agreements were normally concluded with a handshake and a cash payment. As a result, there's no contract backing up Rebellion's claim to own the work, and Morrison has spent the last 20 years blocking reprints. The conflict has split the comics community. Some are just glad to see one of the best-regarded British comics of its generation reprinted. Others are concerned that this is another example of something unhappily common in comics, the visionary genius being screwed over by the money men. But in all the fuss, one person's been forgotten. Steve Yeol, the artist of Zenith. Unlike Morrison, he's outspoken in his support of the reprint, and no wonder. Where Morrison's work since Zenith has bought him a house in LA, friendship with My Chemical Romance's Gerard Way, and an MBE, Yeol still works for 2000 AD, recently concluding the 10-year pirate epic The Red Seas with writer Ian Edgington. He's been locked out of one of his most famous creations for 20 years, and it must be nice to be allowed back in.
Today's podcast was presented by me, Caroline Crampton, with Sophie Elmhurst, Alex Hearn and Philip Morn, who is also our producer. Our theme music is taken from Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.